do.
State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order March 6th. First item on the agenda is House File 112, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's good to be in front of the committee discussing ICE Arena air quality issues. I know the chair enjoys talking about this subject. I see the smile. I have with me today, there are a number of folks from arenas around the state representing Mankato, Apple Valley, Bloomington, Parade, St. Louis Park, and South St. Paul. And I have Jason Dwelly with South St. Paul and Chris Esser that I believe are going to be here to help talk about the need in that House File 112 is resolving. Madam Chair, it's my understanding we're going to move 112 and then lay that one over and then move 868 and lay that one over. Is that the correct process or we're moving them out?
But right now we're talking about just 112. And then you can tell us the difference after we have the motion to lay it over.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House File 112 provides $1.5 million from bonding to the Amateur Sports Commission for grants to local units of government. Traditionally, or historically, the state has provided Mighty Ducks grants to help construct ice arenas around the state. That was done a generation ago, and those buildings have aged, and there have been changes relating to air quality. And air quality standards have just been worked with the Minnesota Department of Health and Administrative Law Judge looking at new standards for indoor air quality. What this bonding proposal does is it provides money to those local units of government to help meet those air quality standards and it also makes some minor changes to the existing statute that relates to the Mighty Ducks grants, allowing for redesign, installation, and renovation of heating, ventilating, and air conditioning systems. The House File 112 deals primarily with carbon monoxide or nitrogen dioxide issues in ventilation. And I do have with me a couple ICE Arena managers to give a practical explanation of the need. Mr. Gilley.
Jason Welly, Gwelly, Paul Ostoff, Mr. Dwelly, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're here to speak of need for this funding for this bill. The industry that we work in has a lot of older, aging facilities that need renovation, that need updating. And the money that this bill originally provided to build those rinks, now those buildings are now nearing 20 plus years old. So this is the next logical step in helping to support those facilities, especially when it comes to the indoor air quality. The Department of Health has been working feverishly on this for a number of years, and having this in place will help those that cannot comply currently with the regulations that are about to be approved by the, I believe they're already been approved by the judge. It'll help those people be able to comply so they can keep their doors open and they can keep the facilities, you know, used by the kids in the communities. So this would go a long way towards, this wouldn't be a complete cure-all, but it would certainly go a long way to helping the worst of the facilities that are having the most trouble, help them to be able to comply with the current regulations and the new regulations as well.
Thank you, Mr. Dwelly. And you're from South St. Paul?
Correct, South St. Paul, Wakota Arena.
Thank you. Mr. Ostoff.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, committee, for taking the time to listen to us. I've come from Mankato, and we're actually an all-electric facility. I don't really have any skin in the game as far as, you know, requiring any funding for this, but what I do care about is when my daughter takes her hockey team to another community and knowing that she's safe and knowing that the kids are safe. And all across the state, there's such a wide variance of this. In our situation, we would not be asking for any of this funding. But it'd be nice to know that when we went to a community that was run by a hockey association that had limited funding, that they had the proper ventilation, they had the proper equipment to monitor that air and making sure that the kids are safe. I think the Department of Health, and I have to applaud them, they've done a great job going around and finding out what's reasonable. But now what we have to do is fund what's reasonable. And by funding it, I think we'd have equity across the state in knowing that our kids, no matter where they go, whether they're at Thief River Falls or down in Albert Lea, Minnesota, that all those ice rinks that we currently have are safe. Not all the rinks will be asking for this money, but I think on a priority basis, based on possibly how their testing has gone or how their building has tested out, some of those buildings will need ventilation system upgrades. Some of those buildings will simply need monitoring equipment that they can't afford at this time. Most arenas, probably half of them, might be able to afford some of this stuff through asking parents for money and donations. But one of the things that's happened in hockey right now is we keep asking the parents to kick in more and more money, and we're pushing out the kids and parents who can't afford the programs. And by raising fees at my facility, I'm going to lose participants at this point because we're pushed right to the limits. And other facilities, I'm sure, are in the same situation. So this money would definitely help keep young hockey players playing. It would help keep the kids with low income playing. And that's really a concern for me and a concern for across the entire state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Ostoff. Any questions? Representative Detmer.
Thank you.
And
thank you, Madam
Paul
Chair.
Paul Erickson from the Amateur Sports Center is available for to answer questions also.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, we have a fairly new facility in Forest Lake, and how does a facility know that they need to have an upgrade? How is this evaluated? Is there a crew that comes around to each facility and does the testing? We have a fairly new facility. What's going to happen there?
Mr. Dwelly.
Madam Chair, we typically, as the rules are written right now, it's on the responsibility of each facility manager to make sure that the air quality is adequate and is below the state guidelines or at or below the state Department of Health guidelines. Right now, we do the testing ourselves. We self-report. Everything is done internally. As far as the newer facility goes, most facilities, when they're newer, are designed for the increased air exchange, for the increased assuming a good engineer worked on the facility. They're designed for better air quality exchange. Doesn't always happen, but it can be a case where even a newer facility might need additional air quality or HVAC equipment to comply with the Department of Health rules.
Madam Chair,
does the Zambonis use, does that have an effect on air quality?
Yes.
Yeah, yes,
Mr.
sir.
Onstop?
The Zambonis used do have an effect on it. So do the devices that do our ice edging or ice maintenance. And those two pieces of equipment are operated daily in the facilities. For the most part, those pieces of equipment are a big factor in what's happening in the ice rink. Having electric Zamboni will reduce that markedly, but also you can monitor it much closer if you use continuous monitoring or if we're meeting that Department of Health requirements. But continuous monitoring is actually the biggest key to this 24/7, and you always know that you have your facility that's maintaining proper air quality. And this would also assist facilities for doing that too. So,
and Madam Chair,
Representative Detmer,
we have $1.5 million. How many different grants are we talking about here, and how many different facilities are we talking about?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, that really will not. That starts to take a bite at the apple. It does not resolve it. There are many facilities that will. If we look at on the page 3, we're increasing the amount of the grant up to $200,000. So potentially for large arenas that may need a number of things, or they install a continuous monitoring, then we're at seven, eight facilities. Okay. It's going to vary based on the size and the needs, but we'll start working at this with the grant that we have.
Madam Chair, one last one. Has there been any reports of illnesses or sicknesses caused by these environments?
Oh, yes, Representative Detmer, there has. Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, in the Duluth area, Representative Detmer, last November, there was an incident, and I think that Representative Newton could also describe a historical one that occurred a few years ago, but this issue continues to come up. The Duluth one involved a number of students that had to be treated. So,
yes, this issue.
And parents.
And parents. Okay.
But we're going back to Representative Hansen. We're also going back to the original idea of the Mighty Ducks funding in the first place, where people applied for grants and they were granted a certain amount. And I don't think Mighty Ducks ever built the place by themselves. So, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to, this is, and I've been in a lot of ice arenas with my kids playing hockey, so I understand the need for to maintain those air handling facilities. My question goes to, what about, and I understand there's more arenas out there than what these dollars will play to, but I understand this is going to the Amateur Sports Commission. Isn't there a better way to do this? So communities that don't have an arena but maybe have a swimming pool or have a different type of facility that doesn't meet the air quality, that we can help more of those facilities without annotating just our arenas.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Howe, the issues here right now, there are new rules that are going to be implemented to meet those standards and to continue to provide access. Indoor air quality at ice arenas is an issue right now. And again, with limited funds, we have to make some prioritization. And my intent here would be when it goes to the Amateur Sports Commission, who works with these folks, that seems to be the best delivery mechanism to deal with the worst first. We want to make sure that we're protecting public health, and I believe the Sports Commission can work with people to make that happen. It is not going to meet all the needs immediately, but it is something where we can start to take a look at it and try to start working on doing that public health issue.
Mr. Erickson.
Yeah, I would just like to augment that. Ice arenas are the only amateur sports facility in the state that has a machine that goes indoors that produces exhaust. There's no swimming pool, basketball court, volleyball court. So I think this deserves the legislator's attention, because we've had numerous injuries of people using ice arenas, and I think this is an immediate problem, and it's the only facility that has a machine that produces exhaust inside. That's why it's an acute problem in ice arenas.
Thank you very much. Representative Hansen, I move that House File 112 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Is there any further discussion? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Hansen, what's the difference?
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
In
the House Files 868 from House File 112.
Well, Madam Chair, the difference is in the amount of money asked for. This is a companion to a Senate bill that was sent over, and it deals with Freon. Freon is a chemical that is being phased out because it affects climate change, and under some protocols for phasing out Freon, we have some issues with Freon. So Mr. Erickson is here to talk about Freon.
Okay, we'll go quickly. Madam Chair, very quickly, over half of Minnesota's 200 indoor ice arenas use Freon R22. The federal government has recently banned this substance. They have until 2020 to go to new systems. And just very quickly, there are two types of systems in Minnesota, indirect and direct. An indirect system has a limited amount of this R22. A direct system, the Freon goes under the ice itself and has many more pounds of it. This is a program like the air quality issue, which helps our Minnesota ice arenas convert from R22 to a safe refrigerant. And again, I bet most of the people around the table, Madam Chair, have arenas that have R22 and have arenas with an air quality problem. So this is something that affects every corner of the state. In fact, you're being handed out a list of arenas that have the R22 problem. And so members can check to see if their community is on that list. And I would guess that two-thirds of this committee has the problem. So it's the same concept. I would say that the air quality thing is the more pressing urgent because we have air quality issues that are affecting people. This is a more of a, you know, a midterm problem. We have until 2020, but we need to start now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Erickson. I move that House File 868 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Hansen,
thank
Mr.
You,
Erickson.
Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ostoff, Mr. Dwelly. House File 98, Representative Sundin. Representative Sundin, please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee members, I have the pleasure of introducing some of the local representatives here. I'll go name by name at the end of my presentation here.
You look very familiar to me, Representative.
They're a handsome bunch, Madam Chair. They represent the Big Lake Area Sanitary District. We have representatives from the City of Cloquet, the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and Perch Lake Township. We have a project that's gained the support of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, members of the Carleton County Board, and the Planning Commission. These folks are here this afternoon to offer testimony that shows why the Big Lake Area Sanitary District is in need of assistance, as outlined in my bill, House File 98. This project has been in progress for 8 years. There have been numerous public meetings and discussions that have brought the Sanitary District to the conclusion that the best way to address the pollution of their lake is to convey the sewage to the City of Cloquet and henceforth be treated by the WLSSD. A survey of lake properties in the fall of 2012 demonstrated that 50% of the on-site septic systems are failing or do not meet the requirements of the Carleton County on-site sewer ordinance. The most logical and cost-effective alternative is to build a pressure sewer system around the lake and pump the sewage to the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District facilities in Duluth, where the waste can be treated to meet the strict environmental requirements of nutrient removal. These requirements would be extremely difficult for the Big Lake Area Sanitary District to meet by constructing their own treatment facility. The logical and cost-effective solution endorsed almost unanimously by the Sanitary District Board and residents unfortunately does not fit the MPCA's parameters of assigning funding priority points. In all likelihood, the project will never be funded under the present point system. The district is asking that we help by moving this project for the reasons to be provided in this afternoon's testimony. And the House of Representatives includes a provision to fund 39% of the cost through a provision of the bonding bill. Representatives, I would like to introduce Tom Luke, supervisor of the Perch Lake Board, to lead the testimony in this project. Tom has been fighting in the trenches since 2004 to bring this project to fruition. Tom was instrumental in helping create the sanitary district. Tom has been involved in working with the USDA to get grant and loan funding to make up the financial shortfall that will remain after the bonding bill assistance. Also providing testimony this afternoon is Mr. Reed LeBeau, who represents the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. We have the Honorable Bruce Algren, the Mayor of Cloquet, to represent the City of Cloquet, and he's also a board member of the WLSSD. And we have a longtime area resident and community activist, Barry Bergquist.
Excuse me, Mr. Luke. Representative Sundin, you convinced me in your opening remarks of the need for this bill. And so I will move that House File 98 be recommended to pass and be referred re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Mr. Luke, would you provide your testimony now?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you. I will keep this short because I know time is of the essence. Representative Sundin hit all of the high points already. For 8 years, we've been seeking a solution to a pollution problem around our lake. We found it worthwhile working with the MPCA. We did get sanitary district status. However, we have a unique land situation where we have a lot of slopes, a lot of wetlands, and we found that we could not place our own treatment facility and adequately treat our waste. The answer to our problem was right in front of us, and that was connecting to the cloquet system and ultimately to WSSD. Unfortunately, that doesn't meet the MPCA points requirements, and it put us at a shortfall for funding, which is why we're here asking you for support with the bonding bill of the $4.5 million. We have unanimous support with all the governing agencies, including the Perch Lake Township, the Big Lake Area Sanitary District, the Fond du Lac Reservation, the City of Cloquet, and WSSD. And with that, I will introduce Reed LeBeau. If Reed has a few things to say from the Fond du Lac Reservation.
Mr. LeBeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reed LeBeau on behalf of the Fond du Lac Band. Just wanted to thank Representative Sundin and you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill. As everybody said, over the last 8 years, all the governments affected have been working together to figure out the most effective and cost-efficient way of bringing this project to a conclusion. The band is happy to be here with our neighbors and friends to support this proposal. It really is the culmination of a terrific working relationship over the last 8 years in trying to problem solve this issue. And we think that it's a great model for how different governments can work together. And we appreciate the testimony by the other folks here today.
Mayor Algren.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. Just want to say that the Cloquet does have the infrastructure and is a willing partner, and as we always have been with our neighbors surrounding us, and also as a member of the WLSSD, we do have the capacity in that facility to take the effluent from the Big Lake area. And it really is an area that Cloquet uses Big Lake a lot, and it's it needs to be cleaned up.
Lots of people have cabins on Big Lake, right?
Yes.
Mr. Berquist?
Madam Chairman, my name is Barry Berquist, and I'm a longtime resident of Cloquet and a small business owner there. I also own a piece of property on Big Lake. I am, like you say, a lot of people do live on Big Lake. Many of them are retired people that live there on fixed incomes. And I am a member of the Big Lake Improvement Association, and they have been living this process for the last 10 or 15 years of finding a way to clean up the lake and make it as beautiful and pristine as it was. They overwhelmingly support this project to go through WLSSD to clean the effluent from the Big Lake. I also want to say one thing is that Big Lake attained national prominence by Henry Schoolcraft in 1832. He was on an expedition to find the mouth of the source of the Mississippi River. And he passed through Big Lake on that expedition, and he said, what a wonderful, beautiful, pristine lake this is, and it was full of agates and cornelian stones. So,
right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Freeman. The PFA is one of the accounts before this committee, or in this committee. And so we'd like a statement from Mr. Freeman, the director of the Public Facilities Authority, about this bill. Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the director of the Public Facilities Authority. I had the opportunity to come before you a few weeks ago, I believe, to tell you about the PFA and the programs that we administer to provide financing for municipal wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects. And with a relatively small amount of state and federal support, those programs work very well to finance the majority of municipal infrastructure needs around the state. They've been very successful, and we're very proud of them. But the priority system and the funding process doesn't fit every situation. And the most challenging situations are typically the unsewered areas, where our programs really tend to focus on small, decentralized solutions for a relatively small number of households. A project that gets much bigger, such as this, it just doesn't fit the process very well. That's not at all to say that it's not a good project. It's an area that does need help. It is a good project. It just doesn't fit the funding process. So I think in that kind of a situation, then it's appropriate that they come before you for a special consideration.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's more a comment than a question, because we've got one of these, actually two of these in our community. And they're a high maintenance. The pressurized system is a high maintenance system that continues to draw a lot of resources to make happen. So I just caution you, if you get an opportunity, as soon as you get done with the loop, to change that to a gravity system, I just recommend you to take a good look at that, because these high maintenance, these pressurized systems do draw a lot of maintenance, and they take a lot of resources to maintain. So that's just a caution, and good luck with that project.
I appreciate your comment. Thank you for your support.
I renew my motion that House File 98 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Go forth. Thank you for coming. House File 117, Representative Gunther. Over the years, Representative Gunther, you have been so kind to me when I've come before your committee, and so I'm pleased and honored to have you before my committee.
Well, thank you. You've always been a fun person to have testify before our committee. I hope I match your expertise.
I bet you will. Tell us about the stormwater project in Truman.
Well, in 2010, we had a lot of Martin County and surrounding counties had a terrible flood. We had 14 inches of rain in the city of Truman. And unfortunately, 80% of the basements were full of water. But the test that FEMA put people under is the water had to be above the kitchen floor. It could be to the floorboards, you know, the joists in the basement could be underwater. But unless it got up there by the kitchen, it wasn't considered a problem. The PFA consequently could not help Truman out either. 60+% of the people are senior citizens and fixed incomes. They can't afford to do it. Consequently, many basements are still not fixed up, and the people in Truman, a lot of them, can no longer get flood insurance to help clean up their basements with large rains. What we want to do with this money, and I'm chairman of members, is simply go and put a new storm sewer system in Truman. We put a trench in there several years ago. The PFA helped us do that. It took care of a third of the city. And now what we want to do is we want to finish the job so the people in Truman can go along with their lives and they can eventually get the mold and the stuff out of their basements and be insured for any eventuality. So with that, I'd like to introduce the mayor of Truman, Lynn Brownlee, and the city manager, Monty Roman. I remember when that flood happened, I spent all day going from town to town in my district. And the Governor Plenty came to Truman to give his speech, and it was very well received. And there was one town, Ormsby, Minnesota, I couldn't get into. Any way I tried, I could not go into the town because it was so much water. We had all the county roads were washed out, or a good share of them were. So it was a real nightmare, and I'd like to have the mayor, who is a nurse, kind of tell you a little bit about her experience with that flood, and city manager, whoever wants to speak first.
Mayor Bromley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for hearing us. Truman is a very small town, but we have a lot of dedicated community members who work very hard to maintain our viability. This has always been their home. They want to continue to live there. And as Representative Gunther said, a lot of them are elderly and on a fixed income. And unfortunately, we don't live in a floodplain, and so weren't thinking about flood insurance. I don't know that anybody really had flood insurance, and consequently, we're left with destroyed homes. We've lost about 100 people in our community, and we're working very hard to attract people in. And with our reputation as a city that floods, it doesn't bode very well for us. We have completed stage one and stage two of our stormwater project. This last phase would do a great deal to eliminate flooding. Even with a couple of inches of rainfall, we still get a lot of flooded areas in town. And this third phase would really eliminate a lot of that. And so we come to you asking for your assistance and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Mr. City Manager.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Truman, of course, a city of about 1,100, and we were lucky enough to have FEMA and state help, special legislation to help pay for our $200,000 in public costs from that flood. We've also suffered major flooding in 1993 and 2005 with larger 4 and 5 inch rains. I did have a handout there, the map of the project, and if you'd want to turn to page 2, you see most of Truman's stormwater system was constructed in the 1950s and has trunk lines that are undersized for even 2 and 3 inch rainfalls. Like they said, Truman invested heavily the last 4 years to address the undersized stormwater system, which is the number one public health and safety priority in our community after we did our 2008 comprehensive plan that was determined to be our number one priority. In 2009, phase one was done to work cooperatively with Martin County to extend a 1 mile open ditch to Truman, which eliminated an 18 inch diameter pipe, which was our main outlet at the time. It was a very nice project. We invested $400,000 in that project, which we're paying for. In 2010, after the big rain, and also we had a 2 and 3 inch rain in the back-to-back evenings in June, the city council did phase two and did 1,500 feet of 60-inch diameter outfall pipe to that ditch coming into our community to get rid of the water. And we borrowed another $400,000 to complete that project. So we invested $800,000 over the last 4 years on those two projects. But the third phase, which we're here to ask for funds for, is the last major part of that plan. And that would extend the 42-inch diameter trunk lines to the north and to the west to hit those areas. And on that second page, it shows the redded areas. Our city engineers drove around town during that flood and mapped out that whole area. It shows where the flooding was, and you see it's pretty extensive around over town. These two trunk lines would get into those areas to get that water out of town faster. And we've got 12 and 15-inch diameter trunk lines right now, which are fed by 8 and 10 and 12-inch lines. The trunk lines are just over. The water just can't go through them fast enough. So this phase of the project is approximately $2.7 million, and just unaffordable for our residents and our business to do on their own. On the second page of that map, also in the there should be some yellow lines. The east and west line is our main street. It's a county highway. It's the highest part of town. And on the west side of the map, in yellow, running north and south, is our old railroad track lines. So the water just can't get. The water flows to the southeast of town, but the water can't get there fast enough because those two areas act like berms. And these trunk lines would get underneath those areas to get that water away from those quadrants of town much faster. And then we're at the bottom end of a 5,200-acre watershed, and we get a lot of farmland, very rich farmland that drains all its water through our town, too. And if we get our water out faster with these trunk lines, that water then could use the same ditch system and go out later, a day later, so to speak. We have tried other sources of funding. As Representative Gunther mentioned, we're not eligible for PFA funding. In the last year, we hired Region 9 Development Commission to apply for funding, for flood mitigation funding through the Minnesota State, Minnesota Homeland Security Emergency Management. They turned us down, said we hadn't had enough big events to allow us for FEMA funding too, so we've run out of all of our other sources of state funding for this project. So if this bond bill would go through with half the cost, we've got a couple state street bonds coming due, and also we did form a new stormwater utility fund that we'd have to probably raise some funds there too, but we could afford our half of the project if we got the other half from the state. So I appreciate your time, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. And having just survived the latest 500-year flood in Minnesota, I know exactly what you're talking about. And Representative Gunther, I know exactly what you're talking about, where the line, water line was on the side of the house and all that stuff. And it takes, now listening to you, Mayor, it takes years and years. And so I move that House File 98 or 117 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment.
Thank you very much.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
And you too may go forth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Simonson, House File 822, and we're almost on schedule. So if we stick to the schedule, we don't have to come back after the convention tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Simonson, and remember, this committee just needs to have the reason. We don't need all the details.
I understand. Less is more.
Thank you, and thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House File 822 is a bill that will simply provide state bond proceeds to develop a shovel-ready water system to enhance the snowmaking capabilities at the Spirit Mountain Recreation Authority in Duluth. This project will provide two important benefits. First, the new system will expand the capacity to make snow and will extend the winter ski season at Spirit Mountain. By doing this, we will increase the number of guests and increase the revenue for the ski hill, the region, as well as the state. Secondly, this alternative water system will take Spirit Mountain off of the city's clean water system and will provide environmental benefits by ensuring that the snow melt from the mountain is safely channeled back into the St. Louis River. I have with me today Renee Mattson from Spirit Mountain, who can tell you about the project. And when Ms. Mattson has completed her testimony, we will stand for any questions.
Ms. Mattson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm a big believer in less is more, so I'll give you the teacup version along with our handout. As Representative Simonson stated, the project we're proposing has multiple ways in which it benefits Duluth, our winter tourism economy, and ultimately Spirit Mountain. The Grand Avenue corridor in West Duluth, which is anchored by Spirit Mountain, has been identified as a tourism corridor for future development, and land has already been acquired around Spirit Mountain by private developers, which will support that vision. So removing Spirit Mountain from Duluth's water system is a very prudent move. Spirit Mountain's economic success will directly affect the economic success of multiple businesses in that corridor in the future. This is an endeavor we've been working on for more than 5 years. It's a project which has the enthusiastic support of the City of Duluth, the Minnesota DNR, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Soil and Water Conservation District, and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. It's important to note that Spirit Mountain has a direct economic impact on the region of $37 million annually. And I would point out that's tough to do in our difficult winter seasons of the last several years. Ensuring there's a viable water supply every fall is extremely important to us, and it's not necessarily a given. With Duluth's aging infrastructure, supporting this improvement makes sense economically as well as environmentally. With the new attractions that we've been able to complete on our own by means of traditional bank loans, we've been able to increase our year-round benefit-eligible workforce by 89%. So this project, though, is simply beyond our means to complete because there's no direct revenue component to offset the cost of the project. We've already secured $1 million in grants with the help of the previously mentioned partners to complete a watershed study engineering, and substantial groundwork already for the construction. Bonding support would enable us to fully finish this important project and allow us to leverage those grant dollars towards the completion. This really is a shovel-ready project. So, I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about this project.
Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just was looking at your handout here, and I'm not 100% familiar with Spirit Mountain. I've seen it when I've been to Duluth, but it says that it was created by session law in 1973 under Chapter 327. Can you just talk about what that structure is? I'm being new to the committee and things, and there's others, too, that may not exactly know what that means, because until I saw that, I thought, well, maybe you're a private enterprise looking for some kind of public subsidy, and I suspect that you're created under state law that my assumptions weren't correct. So if you can help with that, I appreciate it.
Ms. Manson.
I appreciate the question. We are an authority of the state of Minnesota, so that law established Spirit Mountain as an authority of the state. We answer to the city of Duluth and the Duluth City Council, but we're an authority of the city.
Thank you. I move that House File 822 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Capital Investment. Is there any other testimony? All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good luck. House File 172, Represent Pepin. Represent Pepin, you haven't, or there's an amendment. Is that your amendment, A2?
I don't have an amendment. I don't have a copy of it either.
Okay.
172.
Oh. Represent Pepin. I think you should just talk about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that'd be a good idea. Bill's pretty straightforward, and I think it's timely with the sequester going on in Washington, D.C. Simply is that it requires that as part of its budget presentation, each executive agency that receives any of these federal funds would include an analysis of implications for the agency if federal funds are dramatically impacted or reduced by the sequester. Requires the Commissioner of MMB to report to the chairs and ranking minority members of the Senate Finance and House Ways and Means Committee on immediate implications within 30 days of the event that triggers the federal government's inability or unwillingness to meet the prior levels of commitment they'd made. Part of the reason for it, as we all know, that we've been watching Washington, D.C. and what's going on, I just want to lay out a little bit of the impacts of Minnesota with the sequester. Here's just a few things on the White House's list of how sequestration affects Minnesota. The state will lose approximately $7 million in funding for primary and secondary education. About 920 fewer low-income students in the state will receive aid to help them finance the cost of college. Approximately 700 children in Minnesota would no longer have access to early Head Start and Head Start programs. Title I education funds would be eliminated for more than 2,700 schools. Small Business Administration loans would be cut by approximately $900 million. The Food and Drug Administration could conduct 2,100 fewer inspections. The senior program Meals and Wheels could lose $845,000. Child care cuts to the Department of Health and Human Services Child Care and Development Fund would leave 30,000 low-income children without child care subsidies. About $15 million in cuts to Army and Defense workers, and the list goes on. Those are just a few of the examples. So, Madam Chair, that's why I think that this is needed. I think that we need to have a plan B if the government at the federal level can't get things worked out.
Representative Leidiger.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions along the lines of the sequester. When did we know that there was going to be a sequester, and I think that was 2011, if I'm not mistaken.
Representative Peppin.
Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, that's my understanding, too, although I won't claim to be an expert on when the date was that it happened, but I believe it's been a few years.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, because this bill, I know I remember seeing this bill 2 years ago in 2011. We already had known about the possibility of a sequester. We tried to pass this bill, and this bill was vetoed by the governor. And I happen to have his letter here, and I'm reading it, and he says, the financial obligations of the federal government are embedded in current federal laws. They cannot be changed by someone's whim, as the rhetoric surrounding this legislation implies, as though by a whim the budget would change. Well, we've known about something here for 2 years, the sequester, and it's something that we could have planned for, the state could have planned for, and this bill would have if it was in place, we would have known how the sequester or any other changes in the federal budget, how it would have affected the state, and we would have known it immediately. And that's why a bill like this should be passed. It should be something that we do on a regular basis, because there's so many things that can happen in the world, and it's happening right now, such as China moving their missiles to the coast, and they're having problems internally, and who knows if they're going to buy our debt, and yet we know that 40% of our federal budget is debt that's purchased by foreign countries, China predominantly. That means that it may not be able to do that again. So as a question, we bring it right back to you, Representative Peppin. Do you foresee any other things that are coming up in the future that may affect the federal budget or the federal government to live up to their obligations to the states? I can think of one right off the top of my head coming up soon, but perhaps you can shed some light on that.
Representative Peppin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger. Well, I know there's another looming deadline on March 27th. That's probably what you're referring to.
Yes.
And so, this is very disconcerting to me, because 5% of Minnesota state revenue comes from federal funds. And the sequestration over the course of 10 years is supposed to be $1.2 trillion. And, since we do have these deadlines coming up, and the Senate hasn't passed a budget for 4 years, I believe, I really don't know what their plan is. There doesn't seem to be a plan at the federal level, so I think at the very least we need to figure out what we're going to do at the state level and come up with our plan and in reaction to their inaction.
Representative Peppin, do you have anyone that wants to testify for your bill?
I don't.
Okay. Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, is asked to testify. Welcome to the committee. Director Kelly.
Madam Chair, Margaret Kelly, State Budget Director, and I would be remiss to our legislative liaison, John Pollard, if I didn't pull out a photo here
yes,
for you.
Yes, you would.
And I'm not sure how to make this go on. Someone could help me. Thank you, Nancy. I just wanted to...
You've been in the audience many hours this year, and so a picture is very welcome.
Earlier this year, in January, my parents celebrated 35 years of marriage, and it is the second marriage for both of them. So they both have celebrated, been married about 60 years between both of their marriages, but we had the whole family together. This actually represents about half of my immediate family. but all of my siblings were together for the first time in over 10 years.
Oh. Where do you go for Thanksgiving?
This year I went to Afton House Inn.
All right.
The House File 172 requires agencies to conduct risk analysis for federal insolvency and to report on mitigation strategies in the biennial budget document. I don't want to underscore the dramatic effect that sequestration could have on services provided to individuals in Minnesota, but the requirement in this bill is around risk analysis planning. And formal risk analysis planning and risk management analysis is an activity that few state agencies engage in, nor are they funded to engage in that, nor do they have the capacity to engage in that. And while it may be beneficial for the state to take a look at some of this in a more structured approach, agencies currently don't have that capacity. They're challenged as it is to complete any emergency preparedness or continuity of operations planning as it is. Second, our budget document is a snapshot in time. It's a point-in-time view of what is going on with state funding. And I don't believe it would be a useful tool for understanding the impact of all of the recent changes we have had in federal funding. It would not be able to keep up with all of those changes. Also, the language in the bill is open to interpretation. A dramatic reduction is something that we probably would want to better define. The federal sequestration is about a 5.5% in reduction in agency grant funds. And I don't know if I would consider this to be a dramatic reduction in federal funding. It would have a dramatic effect on the services that are provided to folks in Minnesota, but I don't know if it would meet a threshold of a dramatic reduction. Is there feedback coming?
There's something. I don't want to get it to get as bad as yesterday.
But I can tell you what we are doing right now in response to federal sequestration. We have known very little about how the federal government would interpret their responsibility for sequestering funds until just this past week. So while sequestration has been out there for over 2 years, it is something we have not been able to report on the impact of what it would be. We do know that it's about a 5.5% reduction on average to federal grants as they go out the federal door. We do know that overall, based on some preliminary estimates, it could have an $85 million impact on federal funds, that reduction in federal funds that do come to the state. Overall, 30% of the state's budget, all funds, is from federal funds. That's almost $9 billion. Congress continues to talk about how they may mitigate the effects of sequestration. They continue to do it even today. There, however, has been very little information coming out of federal OMB providing guidance to state governments as to how this law will impact funding to states. We have only received guidance from 4 federal agencies so far, identifying how the impacts will occur, but we do not yet know the timing of these impacts. While the sequestration is to federal appropriations, it is not necessarily translate into reduction in outlays this fiscal year. And it depends on whether state grants are forward-looking or whether they are in current year allocations. So while I agree that there is information that the legislature needs to have in response to changes in federal funding, I'm concerned about creating an obligation within our biennial budget document to convey the risk analysis and that information.
Thank you. Representative Leidecker to Ms. Kelly?
Yes.
Representative Leidecker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Kelly. What I'm hearing sounds like we will just, that we're fine to be reactionary, that something happens and we've had the sequestration, we have the debt ceiling limit, we have problems with the acquiring of debt at the federal level. I mean, there's some real problems all the way up to possibly insolvency. And so what I'm hearing is that, well, we'll just react as we go along. Yet,
my questions, really, yet we do have a fiscal note on this bill, which for relatively very little money, it looks as though we can have a proactive plan in place that where we can do some good planning in the possible inevitability that something more drastic does happen. And we're seeing something that has just happened last Friday, which I don't think anybody really saw this, that it was going to happen, although 2 years ago it was, you know, the wheels were put in place. So can you tell me, what would the fiscal note do to get us a proactive plan? Does this make sense to you, the fiscal note? Maybe you can explain a few of the items that we would need to do to have this proactive plan in place.
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm going to ask Michelle Weber from Minnesota Management Budget to speak to the fiscal note.
Thank you.
But first, before that, I'd just like to make a few comments. One, federal sequestration is something we have not been able to plan for. We have had no guidance coming from the federal government in terms of what the level of cuts would be, when the timing would be. If you were to ask any state budget officer, they would say it's an impossible task to plan for something that where there is a vacuum of information regarding it in terms of how it would be implemented. Secondly, I think we have done a good job in terms of anticipating what the impacts would be, and that information could be easily conveyed to members of the legislature right now in front of finance committees. Finally, I'm not sure that it's a valuable effort to finance, to plan for an insolvency that of the federal government going bankrupt. I'm not sure that's something that I envision actually happening. But I'll let Michelle Weber speak to the fiscal note itself.
Ms. Weber, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Director of Budget Operations at Minnesota Management and Budget. And the fiscal note that was prepared on this bill is directly related. The cost identified in the front table is directly related to the report that is required in Section 2 of the bill that indicates that a report is required within 30 days after an event taking place. And so we estimated the level of effort to produce that report would be about 6 weeks of time for two staff, and that while the report is due 30 days after an event taking place, there would be some planning efforts involved prior to, like with sequestration, where we're told of an impending event taking place. But I will echo Ms. Kelly's comments that it is very complicated. We can only put together a report based on the information that's available to us, and that the information has been very hard to gather with respect to sequestration.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you. I'll withhold any additional questioning at this time. But
Representative Benson.
I'm fine.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is for Ms. Kelly. I you know, this bill came around last term. A different legislator, I think, authored it at that time, and that one did talk explicitly about insolvency, as you remember, which prompted a legislator to offer, at that time, a legislator who's no longer on the committee, to offer an amendment much like the A2 here, which I don't think will be offered because its author is not here. But this one, I think, is more of a serious proposal than that one was in terms of insolvency. Can you, if this approach is not to your liking, what do you think, or what would you counsel state agencies to do, or what have you, I guess, counsel state agencies to do in case of a looming sequester, or, as Representative Leidiger alluded to, a looming shutdown, which we might face in a couple of different instances. One is just the late March date, at which time there might be a lack of funds, but there's also the possibility we're also teeing up another debt ceiling fight later on this calendar year, which might also result in reduced funds. So I guess if you're not in love with this approach, is there another approach, or have you been advising state agencies in a certain manner when it comes to these possible scarcities?
Madam Chair.
Director Kelly.
Representative Simon, we did have federal shutdown maybe it was 2 years ago, I believe. And we called agencies together. We did have a conference call. We all listened in to information provided by Office of Management and Budget at the federal level in terms of understanding what the impact of a federal government shutdown would be and what funding would continue to flow to states and what funding would be slowed down or tied up. At that point in time, what we understood the impact of a federal shutdown to be would that it would be a cash flow issue for the state and that some payments would not be made on the regular time schedule, and it all depends on when the actual federal shutdown occurs. In terms of sequestration, what we have done is we have continued to have communications with agency staff who are responsible for federal funds and managing those funds, along with commissioners, deputy commissioners, chief financial officers, budget directors within state agencies, to communicate back and forth between MMB and between those agencies about what MMB knows and about what the agencies know. Agencies have the most direct contact with their federal funding sources and can speak more directly to what their understanding of this impact, how it's going to impact their budgets and the services they provide. To the extent that the legislature has questioned, I would strongly encourage you to conduct hearings within your finance committees with the agencies in your committee purview to understand how a federal sequestration may impact the funding within their budget and the timing and the extent to what they know and what they don't know.
So,
Representative Simon.
So just so I understand, so you're, it's really an agency by agency kind of analysis. You would prefer it not to be, as Section 2 says here, you would prefer it not to be an additional MMB responsibility, but your advice would be to have committees in the proper jurisdiction ask those various agencies about various hypotheticals. Is that fair to say? Am I characterizing it right?
Director Kelly.
Madam Chair and Senator, Representative Simon, I think the best information is coming right out of agencies right now, and we, MMB, is going to agencies to get the information. At the same time, we are collecting that information so that we can communicate it centrally as questions come in. What I've told you so far is pretty much the whole of what we know, and we don't have a lot more detail.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Kelly. I'm hearing a little bit of posturing going on here, and I get a chuckle out of the A2 amendment that, but I believe we're doing this anyway. When you plan on, when you do a planner trip for yourself or anything larger, you try and plan for contingencies that are out there, but you plan for reasonable contingencies that are out there. And I guess the question I have is, if this had been in place 10 years ago, would it have done anything to help us and our state deal with the crisis that was created by the financial meltdown that we had in 2008 and the drop in revenue that we've had and the loss of jobs that we had that created a loss of revenue for the state? Would it have done anything to help that? Because I think that was a bigger crisis than what you're saying, a 5.5% reduction. I think the governor already asked for that of his staff to come forward with budgets that had a 5% reduction across the board. So would this have helped us prepare for that large financial meltdown that happened in 2008?
Ms. Kelly.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a good point that I would also like to add, that within the context of our forecast, we do a forecast in November and we do a forecast in February. And within the context of that forecast, we look at what is happening with federal policy, federal financial policy, and how that may impact the national economy and how that would ripple down to impact Minnesota's economy. And then we reflect any of those changes within our estimates of revenues coming into the state. And so even with this most recent forecast that we did, both in the February forecast and the November forecast, Dr. Stinson took into account, first in November, the impact that a federal fiscal cliff would have on Minnesota's economy, and second, in February, the impact that federal sequestration would have on the national economy, and then how it would impact Minnesota's economy as well. So to some extent, those activities, those policies are being taken into account as we put together our state budget forecast twice a year.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'm hearing that you're already doing this, so this bill to me is a little redundant. And I think I heard a little bit of that the last couple of committees I've been on over the last few days about people talking about why do you need to pass this bill, because it just creates redundancy of things that are already in our state statutes. And I guess that's more of a statement. You don't need to answer that.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, when you said that it's a little difficult to do some of these things because you don't have those numbers, having been a strategic planner in the military for quite some time, we base our, when we don't have facts in front of us, we base it on good assumptions. And I can foresee, just by looking at some of this, that we can assume that some of these dollars aren't going to come from the federal government. And I think it's prudent, I believe it's prudent, to have plans in place, and I can understand that each agency is going to do that, or should be doing that anyway. But isn't it important to have that all brought up in a formalized process and have that plan in place, so if the governor or if the legislature wants to see that plan, that it's there and it's in a document that you don't have to scramble and put it together?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Kelly.
Representative. We currently know that overall, based on the grants that come from the federal government to Minnesota, what is covered by sequestration and what is exempt from sequestration. And a possible impact is about $85 million of federal funding that would be subject to sequestration. What we don't know, because we have not received further guidance from the federal government, is the timing of that reduction, if that is all going to happen in the current fiscal year or if it's going to trickle out into the next fiscal year as well.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Howe. I just wanted to clarify that I'm a little surprised by Director Kelly's testimony, because I have information from the White House site, which I went into the Pew Report and found this White House link, and the numbers that I read before are just this year. It says right on their site, if the sequestration were to take effect, some examples of the impacts on Minnesota this year alone are $7 million in funding for primary and secondary education, $9.2 million for children with disabilities, $3 million for environmental funding, $201,000 in justice assistance grants. So I'm not really clear about the lack of direction that the MMB would have. Earlier, Representative Simon mentioned something about, and I think he did a good job of paraphrasing that. Ms. Kelly talked about how, you know, this is maybe something that we should ask of each agency, but then she also said MMB is collecting agency info. So I'm a little confused as to why there's not information. And Representative Nelson, I'm not sure why you feel this is redundant, because I don't believe that that's currently happening. I don't believe the chair and the minority ranking member of Ways and Means or the Senate Finance Committee are getting information on contingency planning. So I don't know how this is redundant. The only other way we could do this is perhaps require each agency to come in and give us a plan, but if it's not connected to a bill, I'm not really sure how that would work. I guess each chair could have an informational hearing and ask the agencies to come in and testify, but when it's not connected to legislation, I'm not really sure how that would work at this point in the budget process. So a little confused about those two things, but Representative, I agree with your assessment, and I think we do have a lot of information about what's at stake. It's very clearly laid out, the list of things that are going to be impacted this year alone. So not sure why the information isn't there.
Okay. Representative Pepin, you said you got that information from the Pew Report?
No, it was on the White House. I found it in the Pew Report, but the link was to the actual White House site, and it specifically talks about the impact of the March 1st cuts to Minnesota. And so it has a specific list of Minnesota impacts this year alone. Plus, there have been several articles about it in the Pioneer Press and local papers that have listed specific cuts just in the last week or two here that I've got. This one I was...
No, thank you. I just wanted that clarification.
Okay.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Quick comment. I know that we've got other bills that we want to get to today. I will just say this, and I'll be polite about this. With the rough patch that Washington is going through as of late, I don't see that it's going to be smoothing out anytime soon. In the past, when we've had issues like this, just for the benefit of the legislature, when Governor Plenty was here, a new word was introduced into our vocabulary, and that was called unallotment. When the money didn't come in, the governor made the decision. The other would be that the governor would have the right to call a special session, and then the legislature would be back. And so this could be a political football back and forth between the executive branch and the legislative branch if and when this rough patch turns into a more financial burden on the state of Minnesota. So I think it's well worth our time to think about how we would want to proceed on this so that we don't become planning for a rush and having to defend the pass because the governor calls a special session and says, legislature, you take care of this. And so preserving our independence and integrity as the one of the three branches of government, I think we want to think about something on that. Number two is that if we... The comments that Director Kelly made, one of the things just resonated with me that there would be about a 5.5% impact on the state of Minnesota's agencies and that they weren't concerned about that. But yet we've already heard in this committee that they're already strapped for money and are looking for additional appropriations. And so there's a little bit of disconnect on that. And I just think that we need to take this seriously, whether it be Representative Pepin's bill or whether it be some other version or derivative of this, that we start putting something in the drawer that we can pull out and at least have something on the back of a napkin, if nothing else, that we would think about because that rough patch is not going away.
Representative Leidiger.
Well, I've got to agree with Representative Driscoll. And I, you know, I would feel much better if we had a playbook and we gave our executive, the top executive, the governor, something that he had that he could certainly think about and plan about, and I think that that's what this does, and that's ultimately what this is really all about. And as Kelly, what you have here, you have a lot of military people. This is a veterans committee, and I work for Central Command. A week before the first Persian Gulf War, I was in northern Florida, and I was doing a war game. Now, the scenario was a little bit different. It was Russia coming down to, it was Russia coming down and linking with Iraq or something like that. I can't actually remember, but we had played out what we were going to do, our own forces and how things were going to change if such and such happened. And I think that that's the kind of thing we're looking for, and it should be done purely in the economic aspect, like the amendment that was here that I looked at, that's probably something for the Public Safety Committee to kind of handle. And there should probably be some wargaming in that regard. But really, I'm looking for a playbook, and I'm just kind of wondering if the governor, if he had this bill before him now, whether he'd change his mind a year later because of what has transpired at the federal government here just last week. And what's coming up here very soon in the future. So I'd really like to see us push this forward. Let's see if the governor really wants this.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to keep it really brief, and it's just going to be comments rather than questions. Maybe we found the way to balance the budget without any new taxes, because I think I heard you questioned dramatically reduced and didn't think that 5.5% reduction in federal funds was too dramatic. So I might differ, as would many of your agencies, but nevertheless, if that's the case, we just found how we can balance the budget. And then the other comment that you made in terms of risk analysis, not having the expertise, I disagree there, simply because I know from the pension folks, they do risk analysis all the time. My guess is that that's also embedded into your organization. One last thing. When doesn't, at this level, an agency not do contingency planning? I can't imagine that that's not done on a regular basis, and that quarter extra person can't be calculated in making that a little bit more clear and definite in terms of contingency
with what's going to happen at the federal level with it. By the way, in terms of it happening now, my son-in-law is an FBI agent. He's already been told when the days he's going to be furloughed between now and the end of the fiscal year.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, I think we had plenty of discussion on today's bill, but I would like to move that the House File 172 be included in the State Government Finance Bill, and I'd like to have a roll call on this one.
Ms. Melander.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Newton?
No.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Dean's absent. Representative Freiberg's. Representative Howell?
Yes.
Representative Kahn's absent. Representative Crashaw?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Pass.
Representative Purcell?
No.
Representative Swatsky?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wills?
Yes.
O'Driscoll votes yes.
Bill does not prevail.
Thank you for your time.
House File 94. Representative Anderson. Thank you, Representative Pepin. Welcome to the committee, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, just to be brief here, this piece of legislation basically says that when we have a surplus that we need to allocate the funds as outlined in Minnesota Statute 16A.152. I did this piece of legislation expecting that we would have a surplus here, and we did realize that just last week, and was hoping that those funds would be allocated towards paying off the education shift. However, we did pass the tax conformity bill prior to that, and my whole purpose was to make sure that we pass this legislation before that, and now we see that those funds are going to be extracted from that, and basically what that makes this bill is kind of moot at this point, because I'm expecting that we will have the education shift paid off before the next go-round of surplus dollars. But I do appreciate, Madam Chair, you giving me the opportunity to talk about this piece of legislation, but at this point it's beyond the deadline of what we would needed it to have been to make sure that the funds on the tax conformity bill did not take the money away from the education shift. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to speak today, but it's kind of a moot point at this moment.
Thank you. I appreciate your contribution. And Representative McNamara really appreciates you, because he won't have to come back tonight then. Representative McNamara, House File 756. And I move that House File 756 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Many of you may remember this deals with the issue we had a floor discussion on, and both Representative Schoen and I have like bills, so I'm going to present my bill. He's an author, first author on my bill, and I'm a first author, I believe, on his bill, if I memory serves me correctly. Madam Chair, I do have an A1 amendment. I'm wondering if we could move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape of the form I'd like. I think the only thing the A1 does is clarify really what was the intent on the original, and it clarifies and solidifies that only people that were qualified to be in the plan will get reimbursed. There is the possibility that somebody wouldn't have been qualified while they had to pay for the insurance themselves, but now are qualified, we conceivably could be reimbursing. So maybe if you had a son or a daughter who had left your family unit, I'm trying to think of maybe bought their insurance themselves or were out of the country and did something on their own. I can't think of the specific example now, but this would solidify that they were eligible throughout the whole time. And, Madam Chair, I think, and I could stand for questions on the A1.
Madam Chair, I move A1 amendment.
Representative Detmer moves adoption of A1. Is there any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you. And now just to speak to the bill, I believe you may have a letter, I think you do, from a constituent of mine in Hastings that lays out basically that these were letters sent to us. We all actually, if any of you and many of us do in the room here, have dependent coverage on, got a letter. Unfortunately, it looks somewhat like junk mail. And it was the same letter sent, I believe my constituent may be wrong, I believe we only had it sent to us three times, not four, and none of them were certified or registered, and that was a disappointment of mine. When I heard it last summer, I asked MMB to reconsider and to send out a fourth letter registered to, so that people could, at least the state could show that they had proof that these people got the letter. There's actually an example out there of a college professor that was actually teaching abroad and came back after teaching abroad to find the three letters in his school mailbox. And he paid for insurance then for the next number of months because he never got the letters because they were delivered to his school mailbox. I don't know the exact situation, if maybe he rented his house out so he didn't have mail come to his house, it came to a school mailbox. The gist of it is, these are people who actually had real dependents, deserved real state coverage for their plan, and were kicked off because they never filled out a letter that we can't prove they got. So it's really an egregious, and then kind of to add salt to the wounds, Madam Chair, and I really appreciate the latitude to hold it over to work with MMB, and I think we should hear from them, of why did we not have an effort to go after and get restitution from the people that either fraudulently or at least unknowingly collected benefits from the state of Minnesota, potentially in the millions of dollars. The fiscal note was $1.7 million of the savings for folks that were getting this insurance that didn't qualify. We never even sent a letter to the people that didn't. When they found out they had to prove that their spouse was their spouse or their dependents were their eligible dependents, we didn't even send a letter to them to say, hey, how long did you have dependents that didn't qualify? We need to send you a bill for that because you were taking money away from the state of Minnesota that you didn't deserve, and we could have worded the letter nicely to them, but we didn't even do that, and I actually brought that up with the agency to no avail. So that's the bill, ma'am, and I'm here for whatever you want to do.
So Representative Matt McNamara, you have talked with the department.
Madam Chair, I did, not since the bill's been introduced.
Okay. And the letter from your constituent is this letter from
Anthony Alangi.
Okay. Right. And the fiscal note says there's a cost of $301,000.
Correct, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I may, I guess I would like to hear from the agency why that fiscal note couldn't be reversed and actually be revenue to the state if they would just pursue the thousands of people that got coverage that didn't qualify.
Is there anyone here ready to testify for or to answer Representative McNamara's question?
Good morning. Hi, Madam Chair, Nathan Morocco with Minnesota Management and Budget. Madam Chair, before I begin, and out of respect for your time, I want to just check with you to see if I should show a picture or not. I don't want to be the reason you all have to come back at 6:45. I work for the state. I'll be back in front of this committee on many bills, so if you prefer to defer, I can certainly do that.
Let's wait till the end.
All right. Sounds good.
Give your testimony on my motion first, or my bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to be clear, would you like me to testify on behalf of the entire bill or specific to Representative McNamara's
specific
request?
Specific to the question that he just answered, and then your prepared remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think it's a good question. I don't believe that it was the intent of the original bill was to go after potential prosecution of the dependents, essentially to the extent that employees either were unaware that there were fraudulent dependents, to the extent that they chose not to comply with the audit. We wouldn't necessarily be in a position to be able to differentiate between the two. Keep in mind that an audit simply requires you to continue the coverage to provide the documentation necessary to demonstrate that the dependents are truly eligible. Certainly it is under it is each individual's choice to choose whether or not to comply. Some folks may be uncomfortable with the idea of providing certain types of documents to demonstrate the validity of the dependent, and it's within their rights to drop that coverage. So we wouldn't necessarily be in a position to be able to discern that. I think if we were to take that discussion further, not only if we were able to do that, or if we were compelled to do that, we would not only, I think, have to take financial action, I think we would also have to take employment action. I think if an employee is defrauding the program, I think we're getting into a whole other space from a labor relations perspective, and certainly it was not the intent as I saw this bill through. I have been here with the state for 10 years. I did follow the original bill back in 2011, and never was that ever discussed. And certainly, we have a very positive relationship with the unions, in terms of how we manage the program, and I don't think that was ever the intent.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one thing. The bill only covers those who have now provided the information and have been reinstated with insurance. If they made a decision to not provide the forms, this bill wouldn't get them any restitution. It only gives restitution to those folks that have now stepped forward and provided the forms. And in regards to the testifier's remarks, you need to realize we charged people who actually had legitimate dependents, and they paid thousands of dollars. Those that didn't have legitimate dependents, we didn't send a letter to them to tell them to send us the money. I'm not talking about prosecuting them. I would imagine they did it by accident. Why not send them a letter and say, for how long did your dependents get coverage that they weren't qualified for? Please send us this money. We don't need to prosecute them or put them to jail. I would make the assumption that it was accidental, but we should get the money that we have coming.
Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then to the broader nature of the bill. Nathan Morocco, I represent the State Employee Group Insurance Program, so you may hear the acronym CGIP. And the laws of 2011, the special session, the legislature required that the program offer a document-based audit. And there was a lot of discussion about why we were trying to audit, the potential savings of the audit, and the varying degrees of savings depending on the specifics of the audit, whether it be an affidavit versus a document-based model. It required that CGIP RFP for these services. They did not want us to do any of this in-house, at least the initial audit. And it required that we had a contract in place by January 1st, 2012. It did require that the savings of $1.7 million, as the representative indicated, the $1.7 million savings were a part of the final budget solution as part of that special session in 2011. Over 97% of state employees complied with the audit. That means that they did provide us documentation that we could review. That leaves 3% that didn't. And again, keep in mind that some employees either don't want to provide that documentation, or some employees know that that the dependents did not qualify and simply chose not to respond. We did also see approximately 1% of the dependents come back as a result of the subsequent open enrollment. So the actual numbers that were unable to comply or unable to verify their dependents was extremely small. To the point about communications, every employee received at least 4 personalized mailings from the CGIP organization, which was co-branded with the vendor, HMS, as well as the CGIP logos. It's the same address and the same logos and the same type of materials that come out every open enrollment that we use to communicate with our members. If you are a new hire and you are going to get new hire information, you are going to receive the same kind of letter, the same kinds of logos. So everything that comes from our organization has the similar look and feel from the CGIP organization. There were also, in addition to the 4 mailings that came out, there were 2 additional mailings that were sent to all employees for the 2012 open enrollment as well as the 2013 open enrollment that provided general understanding about what the audit was, what it was about, and what the likely upcoming mailings were going to be asking of each employee to provide, and that these additional 4 mailings would provide all the details necessary for understanding the compliance requirements. In addition to that, there were also additional emails that came out both from HR offices as well as the unions representing state employees. There were 2 additional grace periods that were provided to all employees. Keep in mind that this audit took place over the course of a 4-month period of time. During that time, in consultation with the legislature, we understood that there was concerns about the ability of state employees being able to comply with the audit. So there were 2 specific grace periods that were given. These grace periods did not require any explanation as to why an employee did not comply with the audit. It was simply was taken at face value that there would be many reasons why an employee may not have been able to comply, and simply provide the documentation during those 2 grace periods, and those dependents would be able to maintain their eligibility. At no time was coverage ever terminated during these grace periods. So the benefit of the doubt was given to all employees that all of their dependents were eligible until they existed and until they had expired both through the original audit period as well as the grace periods, and then at that point, if eligibility could not be verified, that was the point in time at which we canceled coverage prospectively.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. Representative McNamara.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to say this is the right thing to do to have this bill included in your state government bill, and I look forward to that day when it will be included in your bill.
Representative McNamara, do you want to? Did you carry the bill in 2011?
Madam Chair, I believe it was part of the state government finance bill is where this was carried in, this provision to include this. The idea of this provision is a great idea, Madam Chair. I don't think anybody questions that we don't want to have people get insurance benefits that aren't eligible. But the sad thing is we did that, and as Mr. Morocco has said, 3% of the people, for whatever reason, didn't answer the form. The reality, if you look at the example of the college professor who wasn't even in the country, how in the world can we justify to him that because he was out of the country teaching for one of our state institutions, we're going to cancel his dependent coverage? There's no logic in that. And if you want to sit here and try and defend that it was some paperwork deal and it looked okay and whatever, why don't we just admit we made a mistake? If we have to pay the $300,000, we got to pay the $300,000. My point is, why aren't we sending a letter to the 2% of the people that got it when they weren't supposed to? Just a letter to them to say, you know, you collected insurance coverage, you didn't fill it out. We're wondering if you could let us know how much or who was or what was the situation. Some of them was probably an accident.
Representative McNamara.
I'm done, Madam Chair. Thank you for your time.
Representative McNamara, are you willing to
–
work with me, and Mr. Morocco, will you come and explain a little bit more history to me on this issue and see if we can get better than a this way or my way or no way kind of an approach?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that and work with Representative and yourself.
All right. Then I'll renew my motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. And it was possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your time.
This meeting is adjourned. I'll see you on Monday.